You've stopped in at the Guidepost, brought to you by the American Saltwater Guides Association. Stock up on gear, grab a coffee at the counter, and get ready to hear incredible fish stories from the best captains on the East Coast and thought-provoking conversations with stakeholders and policymakers working to protect these fisheries. This podcast is presented by Costa Sunglasses.
What is up, everyone? Happy Friday, TGIF. Cap Cody Rubner here, tuning back in for the Guidepost, leading us into a great weekend. Hopefully everyone's going to go out and do some fishing. This one here is just a quick chat introducing a longtime friend who actually, ironically, is originally from Connecticut. If you have not listened to our last episode that featured two guests from Connecticut Deep, DEEP, it was outstanding. We've had great response already from people learning more about the outdoor rec initiatives, hearing that state's approach to outdoor recreation and how they see the value of it and conservation and dam removals and fisheries and all sorts of goody stuff. So if you haven't listened to the last one's definitely a good one. A little bit of a twist on some of the ways that we approach some of our episodes, and it's heard great responses so far. So let us know. Give us a listen. If you hated it, let us know. If you love us, let us know, and everywhere in between. But today, I'm going to introduce a friend, Mr. John Carlucci, who is tuning in from Maine right now. John currently works at the Pelagic Fisheries Lab under Walt Gallette. And while we're going to talk a little bit about his work, we're also going to talk just a little bit about his schooling and, you know, his path through fisheries and what he might be up to right now and research and this and that and tuna heads and whatever other fly fishing stuff he's up to this year. But on top of all that, just want to introduce John, because John has been in this game for a while and has a really, a highly skilled professional approach to a lot of the stuff that goes into the fisheries management conversations that many of you advocates are involved in. So we're hoping we're going to hear John's voice on not just on the podcast more, but also involved in some of the conversations we have about striped bass and tuna and albies and whatever else we get into. So without further ado, John, what's up, dude? How are you living?
What's going on? Good to hear from you. Happy to be here. Thank you for the invite.
Yeah, of course. Glad to have you. So our listeners likely do not know, unless they also went to school with us, but me and you went to school together at the University of Maine from, sure, what would that have been, 2013 to 20. We were the class of 2017. I believe I graduated. I'm not entirely sure. They never sent me the piece of paper. John, I was out fishing and playing basketball and building fishing clubs and doing extracurricular community stuff, and John was helping with my homework. So we have a good working relationship that budded many years ago. But John stayed in school after his graduate degree, and so why don't you give people just a super quick, you know, it doesn't have to be 7 years ago, but a little bit about where you grew up, how you ended up at University of Maine, and then how post grad, you know, what your path was to getting to the Pelagic Lab right now, and then we'll go from there.
Sure. So I grew up in Danbury, Connecticut. It's all the way on the western edge of Connecticut, right on the New York border. And I grew up mostly fishing for like bass and panfish in a tiny little man-made reservoir, you know, water supply reservoir through the woods by my house. That was kind of where I learned everything that I knew going to Orono. Before I went to school, is pretty much where I spent most of my time, was in those woods and around that reservoir. We spent some time down fishing from shore, you know, Long Island Sound for blues and striped bass, some time up in the Cape when we would go on vacation. But for the most part, my fishing growing up was all just kind of puddle species. I was trying to decide where I wanted to go to school. And at that time, I don't know if you had this experience, but a lot of the schools on the Eastern Seaboard that offered a marine science program were just hemorrhaging funding hand over fist. And the one thing that I wanted, like, vehemently was field work. And when I went and looked at a bunch of different schools, I finally went to go visit Maine. I went to Maine once when I was a kid. It was a lot of fun, but I'd never been to Orono. And I showed up in April for a campus visit, and it was like 44 degrees. Raining sideways. The old town mill was still in operation, so the entire town stunk like a paper mill. I just remember getting out of the car, looking around, being like, who the hell would ever go to school here? This is miserable. It stinks. It's cold. It's wet. It's muddy. And then I met with Dr. Ellis, who's like a huge advocate and asset for UMaine and the School of Marine Sciences. And when I met him, he was uniquely non-stuffy. He didn't have like the bow tie and the briefcase and, you know, the fancy glasses like some of the other folks that I met with. He had Carhartts. He had a flannel on. They were all ripped up. He had steel toe boots and a knife on his hip. And he was like, yep, so we prioritize getting students out in the field. And 2 weeks later, I made the decision to go to Maine. And I've never left.
Yeah, hell yeah.
So I went to Maine, again, for marine science, but I was a double major. I did environmental science in addition to marine science and always wanted to be on the fisheries end. So I took a minor in fisheries science as well. Held some really cool jobs while I was there. I got to work for the Department of Marine Resources and the Diadromous Fish Branch at the Milford Dam. That was a cool experience.
I actually held the same job.
That's right.
But yeah, I think two summers after you, but that was really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a really cool exposure to a lot of the big ticket fisheries problems. But I got to do that for a summer. That led into a job with NOAA. NOAA used to have a field office in Orono. That led to a job with Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, which was amazing. I got to fish all over Baxter, all over Region F, which is like all the Penobscot headwaters. Super, super fun time. Saw some really beautiful places. Really cut my teeth on fishing for trout and salmon and all the things that Maine has to offer. But as I kind of rounded the corner on my undergraduate work, I got a job working for Yong Chen, who was a population dynamicist at the time in Orono. He has since left Orono and is now at SUNY Stony Brook. But he offered me a graduate position running a groundfish survey from the western edge of Penobscot Bay to the eastern edge of the U.S. That's the Canadian border, for cod, halibut, hake, all kinds of fun stuff. So did that for a couple of years, got my master's, and then I left. And I always wanted to pursue tagging. So I took a job with an environmental consulting firm. I had done a bunch of the job that you had just mentioned, the Milford Dam job. All those dams have to go through relicensing cycles. Some part of their compliance is biological compliance. And so that was what I did. I had sort of Maine was really all of New England was my region, but I lived in Maine. The company was in New Hampshire. And so I generally got sent to the Maine sites to do studies on river herring, shad, eels, salmon, you know, all kinds of cool, fun species. So I did that for a couple of years, and then I decided I wanted to shake things up a little bit. While I was doing that, I kind of got away from a lot of the stock assessment stuff I had done in grad school, and I just was doing a lot more like data visualization and automating really repetitive processes. So I decided to shake things up. I ended up working for an oyster farm for a little over a year, doing their wholesale. When I was in grad school, I failed to mention this, but when I was in grad school, I had Walt Gullett as one of my committee members. Very good advice was given to me to, when you go for a master's, generally you have three people on your committee. You have your advisor and then two people that you choose. And I was told, pick somebody who's going to make your product really strong and pick somebody that you might want to work for that isn't in your wheelhouse. And so for me, that was Walt. Walt is much more of a biologist. He has a lot of hands and a lot of cookie jars that have to deal with population dynamics management, all of those things. But biology is really his background. He was the only one on my committee that had that background. And I was always super captivated by the work that he did with, you know, the big charismatic, highly migratory species, bluefin, sharks, billfish, you know, you name it, tropical tunas, all kinds of stuff. So anyway, while I was working at the oyster farm, Walt decided that he needed a full-time quantitative fishery scientist, and I had been chomping at the bit to work for him. I volunteered for him at the tournaments the lab used to work for years, and then finally an opportunity opened, and I snuck right in. So I've been there since 2023, and And at this point, I do a lot of that tagging stuff I was obsessed with in college is what I'm doing now. So I'm very fortunate, very, very lucky to have found my way to what was a dream when I was 10 years old.
I love it. Well, listeners, you can already tell why John was helping me with my homework, because while he was doing all the brilliant stuff that he just described over the last couple of minutes, I was, showing off an intramural basketball championship games, which, believe it or not, never led to my career in the NBA. It was so close. Almost made it.
You were so almost close. Made it. You give me too much credit. I cut plenty of classes to go fish in Bangor.
That is fair, but I guess you were smart enough to cover your ass when you did so. So, no, all jokes aside, I mean, it's really cool. It's a really cool, transparent look at one of the many ways there can be a path in the careers, scientific careers. There are so many different paths. There's so many different ways that they can go, and they can be difficult too. Like seeing the forest through the trees and trying to find your way to it. And we'll tap into it a little bit here, but we honestly could do a future podcast, and maybe with Sam and some other people as well, is like, what getting a career in the sciences, in fishery sciences, because that's all. That's hours in and of itself. But
for sure, you need a week to talk about that.
Yeah, but I think that's an awesome example of one way that it could be done, which is not only did you found a school that you thought would nurture the way that you wanted to pursue your career, right? There's different styles of scientists, and I don't just mean that by literal fields or, subject matters of study, but also their approaches, right? I mean, we knew it. Our class was at UMaine, at least. It's like you go to SMS 100, you go to the first marine bio class in freshman year, and it's in a giant hall, and there's like 200 people in the class. And everyone's like, I'm going to play with dolphins when I grow up. And then you get to sophomore year, and they're like, analyze the chlorophyll, and suddenly there's 30 people in your class, right? It weeds it out really quickly. So
the
you do have to.
Is steep.
Yes. And I'm surprised I made it over that. I was hanging on by a thread with my fingers, but no. So there's a lot of ways that it can play out, and it's cool that you at least knew your guiding star as much as, you're 18 at that point, an 18-year-old kid could. You're like, maybe I don't know exactly how this is going to play out, but I really like science and I want to be in this hands-on stuff. And there are definitely different types of scientists. We went to school with some kids that you're like, that's a computer kid, And I don't mean that as an insult, but I just mean it as an accurate description. Like, that's someone who is brilliant and should be working on numbers and just numbers. But if they had to describe those numbers to people, the people listening would be like, is this an AI robot? What's in front of me right now? Like, what is happening? Did Elon Musk create this person? Right. So that's one type of scientist. But then there are people who are really good in the field, and maybe they're more of, they have an influence of like an outdoorsman. They have a great touch in the field and better instincts in the natural world. More of a hands-on approach is a better fit for them, maybe just not just their learning style, but how they can have a better impact. But those people might not be the best lab people, or when it comes to a statistics test, they weren't the top of the class. And that's not, obviously accuracy is important with science, but the reality is that there's all these different types of people. And so being able to find your way in science, we'll definitely have to tap back into this in a little bit deeper. A deeper dive here as its own standalone thing. But because I'm sure we could give some sage wisdom towards how to find those opportunities, and because it's tough. I mean, you really have to scrap. Like all those things. It wasn't like you just, walked up and said, hi, Department of Marine Resources, I love fish and I want a cool summer job. And they're like, no way, we have 100 at the dam. Come work it. Mm-hmm. Like, it really, you still have to separate yourself and you still have to have connections to find those spots. But we should take a quick detour, because we both did that Milford Dam job, and tell people a little about it. And not even from maybe the science side, but also just people might be interested to hear what that experience is like as a kid. It's cool that, man, you were at school and this is what you did the summer between. So there's a dam, the Milford Dam, just around the corner from our campus. Most people don't know. So our campus was Orono, Maine. It's the flagship. There's a UMaine system, but that's the flagship HQ for the UMaine system. And it's on an island. even though it is, I forget the exact distance, what, 100 and something miles from the coast, but there's a river that comes up in the center of Maine, and then there's also another branch off, so you have the Penobscot and the Stillwater, and they split to make a full loop around the island. So to get on to the campus's island, even though you're a long way from the ocean, you have to get on one of the little bridges to come on, which most people might not know. One of the dams right around the corner from our campus has this state-of-the-art fish ladder. And so essentially, John will explain it better in scientific terms, but in layman's terms, which is my language, it is a massive operating system where you essentially are using a separation of flows to guide the migratory fish that are coming up to the dam into this corner. They get lifted up into this giant glass room, essentially. You're inside it. You monitor what's in there and you make counts on what comes through. And then if there's specific stuff that you want to select out, you can use a little lift system, separate those fish, move the gates, and try to guide the stars of the show, a la Atlantic Salmon, into that gate. It lifts it all the way up to the top of this giant platform. You're wearing a hard hat and boots. You go all the way up to the top, and then that fish is up top, and you can pit tag them and do all your research and stuff. So it's really cool because you're quite literally getting to be the window into the river as all these migratory fish are coming back. I had a really cool experience in that my senior capstone research was about sturgeon, Atlantic and short-nosed sturgeon, and their diet and prey availability in the rivers. And up until that point, sturgeon had not returned. That was one of their natal rivers that they used to return to, but they had not gone past that point. And lucky enough for me, the summer that I was there was actually the first sturgeon that came back, and we got to lift them up and pass them by. So
yeah, you sent me that picture when you were working that day, and I was so jealous because I worked there for months and I never saw a sturgeon.
It was really cool. It was really cool to get a hands on. So like, these are the type of things you got to do, and while you're in college, which was, you know, invaluable. But maybe if you want to take a little deep dive too, or just a fun memory, or if you just want to say ditto, we can move on. But I think people understanding that that's an opportunity, and like, what does it mean to work at a fish ladder, is something that a lot of people don't get to hear about on a day to day.
Yeah. So I think I'd start just quickly by saying, I think it's a little different now. So when you and I were there, not to age ourselves, but it was state
Back
of the art.
Back in my day.
Yeah. 10 years ago, it was state of the art.
True.
So there's all kinds of changes that have been made in those 10 years. And one of the big ones is that the power company that actually operates that dam, they have their own biological compliance specialist who hires their own team, essentially of summer interns, to do what we did for the Department of Marine Resources. The department's still there. They still have a job with, you know, Atlantic Salmon are obviously federally protected, and the DMR will never let that go. That's fine. But the power company has actually picked up quite a bit of work. And the only other thing I think I'd add is, when we were there, salmon were definitely the star of the show. I mean, that was what funded that position, was trying to make sure that the research was being done on something that was such a dwindling resource. But I think the unsung hero of those couple of years was the alewife return.
Yeah.
You know, when when we saw salmon, we'd see, I don't know what, 100, 200. And a lot of those were,
I think,
were
I had one of the
fish.
Worst years. I don't remember the exact number off the top of my head right now, but I want to say, like, you know, over the entire summer, we passed 100 and something at that. And for people's perspective, like, to historical levels, that's dirt.
Nothing.
I mean, it's spit. Yeah. It's nothing. And there have been a couple great years after, and you might have some more context on this, but that specific river, the Penobscot River and the Atlantic salmon that return there, are relatively iconic. I mean, there's a whole book, The President's Salmon, right, that you can go read about, that the back in the day, there used to be salmon clubs along the river, and, you know, a prized possession. And if I remember correctly, The President's Salmon, the book itself, is about the fact that the first salmon every run caught on the Penobscot River was delivered directly to the President of the United States.
Yep, that's absolutely right. Yeah. Great book, great read if you're interested. A lot of those salmon clubs, a lot of them got torn down, but there are still a few. They just obviously don't fish for salmon because it's illegal. So now it's basically just a bunch of old dudes that like sit around and play cribbage, talk about the good old days. there's great value. There's great value in talking to those guys. You want to hear some good stories? They are loaded with good stories. You can't see them in action, but you can hear the stories. But just quick to get back to alewives, because I think that's one of the sort of rare success stories in fisheries management, particularly in New England. There at the time that Cody and I were doing that job, the couple of years, it was the 2 years that separated us, those that handful of years, probably a 5 year window, there was a ton of effort put into isolating alewives and blueback herring as they were running up. And then instead of just passing them above the river, the first, you know, certain number, I think for us it was the first couple of 100,000, we would put in that sorting tank up on that upper deck. And instead of sending them up into the head pond for the dam to continue up the river, we loaded them up in a truck. And they had selected deliberately ponds that had historic runs of alewives coming out of them. And they stocked them in there to try and help that population rebuild. And I think, don't quote me on numbers here, because this is now over 10 years ago, and I'm just trying to remember. But when I was there, they had started, and I was there in 2015, they had started that stocking program in 2012. Mm-hmm. And the estimate for returns that year was supposed to be somewhere in like the 125 to 150,000 fish range. Mm-hmm. We got over 800,000 fish that year. And the year after that, they were over 1 million.
Yeah, I was going to say like 1.1 or 1.2, I think, if I remember correctly.
It was a crazy, crazy resurgence. And the whole idea was that, you know, they're valuable fish for a lot of reasons, but one of the sort of easy things to do in fishery science is to justify what you're doing by showing how it's valuable to something that's federally endangered.
Yeah.
So they said that, you know, a lot of the juvenile herring, when they run out, they'll run out on the surface and the salmon will run out below them. And so they're sort of protected from aerial predators and surface pressures and whatnot. But to come full circle on that, years later in 2018, 2019, my now wife was doing her master's work on bluefin foraging ecology. And she's the first one to have documented a river herring in a New England bluefin stomach. And so it was just like a really cool success story of, I remember that project when it was in its, you know, relative infancy. It had been going for a few years, but not many. We had returns way better than anybody had anticipated. And then now they're showing up in the stomachs of highly migratory species. So it's like front to back, you start the thing, it actually works. And now you see it bleeding into, you know, benefiting something as big as a bluefin tuna. It's a very cool full circle approach for
definitely
for a winning species.
Yeah. And we're planning to get Sammy on here and Walt on as well. And I think after listeners hear Sammy talk for a while, we'll have to have you back on to explain how y'all kicked your coverage, because she's brilliant and smart and funny and pretty and
there's me.
And, you know, you're you. So that could be a shocking and really compelling podcast follow-up as well for, you know, maybe our listeners who are down on their luck.
I don't know that I want to bring all that to her attention. I'm just kind of riding that wave that she hasn't figured it out yet.
We might keep that quiet. If you're listening to this, find Sammy on social media and shoot her a message about how tall, strapping, handsome, and smart John is. But no, jokes aside.
Please.
really, really cool stuff. And those are the type things that drive a career in fisheries, right? Like, mm-hmm. I remember when I got that opportunity, how excited I was. And that was the most fun and simple summer. Obviously, you're not making a lot of money at all.
Nope.
I was staying in, where was it? Where did I can't remember where I lived at the time. I can't remember if I lived in like fraternity house or someone's, I actually might have like rented out a room in someone's apartment that owned a house for the summer or whatever. I think that's what I did, but I basically
subletted what was essentially a closet.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Harry Potter's little, under the stairs shack, but basically worked at the fish ladder every day. Counting fish, super hands-on, you know, a little monotonous, but also like that's what you dreamed of as a kid. Like that's why you went into marine biology, was to get these opportunities. And then we would wrap that up, normally go home. And I remember that summer, for whatever reason, we watched a lot of Family Guy. But I would just go home, watch the Family Guy for a little bit. And then there was another gentleman named Owen. I don't know if you ever met Owen Muldy McFerrin.
I think so.
Another gentleman who's had an awesome career in the sciences. But we were both working there at the time together for that summer. We'd go watch a little TV. We would pack up one of the trucks. We would drive down to Portland and we would fish throughout the night for striped bass under moonlight. And then we would drive home and like barely get a couple hours of sleep and then walk in groggy-eyed and count fish again. So really
so
cool.
Your mistake was leaving the Penobscot.
I know.
I did, well, we did, I did fish all there of those too. Things. I just didn't leave.
We did that too. And you'd be surprised, our striper lovers and striper advocates, you would be surprised how big of a fish migrates how far up that river. I mean, Owen caught a really, really big, I can't remember if it was upper 30s or low 40s, and if it was a 30, maybe 37, 38, I mean, hundreds of miles from the ocean.
Which in 2015 to 2019 was crazy.
Yeah.
To get those fish that high. But I feel like it happened every year that we were up there. You know, it was almost like that 1 7 to 9 pound salmon that somebody would catch out of one of those northern Maine waters. And it was like, there's one guy every year that's going to do it. And you don't know who it's going to be, but one person is going to catch a fish that big. And it was the same with the Milford Dam. It's like one person will catch a 40 plus inch striped bass.
Yep.
Under the Milford Dam.
That was enjoying a smorgasbord of bait by itself all alone. And then finally got tricked. It was enjoying 1.2 million alewives by itself.
Yeah.
And so drunk and happy that it fell for whatever crap Owen was chucking at it. But no, so that was a really cool opportunity. And Maine's a really special place, man. It really is. It's very easy to fall in love with.
That part of Maine is particularly special. I mean, that is such a unique area.
Yeah, if you're going for the nightlife, you don't go to Orono. If you're going for the sports, depending on the sport, you either do go to Orono or you most definitely don't go to Orono. Very polarizing there, depending on the sport. Amazing hockey school and hockey town, and really passionate fans. But that area of Maine is really unique. I mean, the smallmouth opportunities, you're within an hour to some crazy, you know, pike habitats, which are, you know, invasives, but like all that central Maine stuff that you and I have fished together, really, really cool. And then you're within a couple hours of all these badass landlocked salmon fisheries and brook trout and all sorts of stuff. And Maine is really
trout. A lot of the brook trout waters are heritage waters too. I mean, those aren't like hatcheries. There are clearly hatchery supplemented bodies of water, but there's a lot of native strongholds up in that area.
Right. And Maine IF&W specifically, I mean, that's one of their steadfasts. Like, they do everything that they can to protect their wild and native species. What was it like for you as just an angler? You talked about working with IF&W and some of the cool places you got to go, and not from the professional side, but just as an angler to get to branch out and experience all the different parts of Maine. What was that experience like? What did you fall in love with? And what now living there full time, you know, owning a place, having your family there, what catches your heart on a weekly basis of, if I get a day off in between all my research and the tuna tournaments, I'm going to go do X?
That answer is easy. I mean, in doing all of that, I fell in love with Maine. That's all of those experiences are the experiences in why I never left. After school and stuff, it's for anybody looking for a job in fisheries in Maine, you're putting yourself in a limited pool. And I couldn't leave because of those experiences. I couldn't make the decision to turn around and walk away from so many beautiful, pristine fisheries that just, there's nowhere else like it. I mean, there's one experience that really stands out in my mind. A really good friend of mine, he's best man at my wedding, caught without moving his feet and without changing his fly, caught a big smallmouth bass, a schoolie striped bass, not a monster, but a schoolie, right? Second cast after the smallmouth, then caught a native brook trout, didn't move his feet, didn't change his fly, caught all three of those species. And I don't know how many places in the world you can do stuff like that, but I can tell you that is definitely limited.
Yeah.
And when you have one, I mean, it's just, you got to grasp onto it. So Maine was really, I learned how to fly fish in Vermont. And by learning how to fly fish, I mean, I got taught how to, you know, be a glorified ribbon dancer, but I wasn't very good at actually catching anything. Maine was really where I cut my teeth on that, particularly on the Penobscot. Particularly on those nights, you know, we would go fish until 1 o'clock in the morning for schoolie striped bass, and you'd catch over 200 fish a night. Like, you'd leave because your arm hurt and you couldn't physically cast anymore, or you had no skin left on the inside of your thumb, not because the fish weren't biting, you just couldn't do it anymore. So having fisheries like that, having smallmouth fisheries where, you know, you can go out and have days on bodies of water where your average fish is 3.5 pounds and they're just blowing up on topwater mouse patterns or Dahlbergs or whatever. And we, you know, you go, you can catch them and they're all puking up juvenile alewives, like 30, 40 juvenile alewives. They're just big, healthy, hard fighting, fish. And then of course you've got all your salmon and your brook trout waters, or you're up in the mountains and gin clear water, or, you know, even if it's a lot of main water is tannic, even if it's tannic, it's still crystal clear. Seeing those fish is just, it's incredible. The IFW job was awesome because there were a couple weeks that the heart of that job was actually creel surveys. I'd go and I'd interact with fishermen, up on East Grand Lake. And the whole point was to try and assess sort of changes to what used to be a trophy landlocked salmon fishery. And a lot of the sporting guides up there are sporting lodges. They've kind of transitioned to smallmouth trophy fishing because the salmon fishery has just degraded. But outside of that part of the work, we had to do all the regular pond surveys. So like we'd go up to Baxter for 4 or 5 days with gill nets and a list of ponds that we needed to sample. You go and you do your work for the day. But as you know, because you've been there, you know, the listeners, maybe not, but if you haven't been to Baxter, Baxter is remote. It is very remote. It is a huge, beautiful state park right in the center of the state. Katahdin is right in the middle of it. So either the end or the beginning of the Appalachian Trail for you hikers. But it's remote. So like if you're going up there for a day, you're working, you're staying up there for the 4 days that you're going to be there. There's no sense in driving back home. You'd spend more time driving than you would working. And so the benefit to that was that we got to go stay in a lot of the state lodges. You know, these are for like the park rangers or whoever was going up to do maintenance. The biologists would use it when they were doing their surveys. So we'd go do our work for the day, which was like a regular work day. And then you have all this time where you're just stuck up there.
Now what?
So I'm stuck up there with a fly rod and a canoe. Mm-hmm. And so we would just go to all of these different ponds, and the variety of ponds up there is unbelievable. Some of them look like Caribbean water. You know, they've got these little like freshwater mysid populations. Those fish are like scarlet when you go to fillet them open. They're just beautiful. Then you got some of your, you know, normal tannic main ponds, but it's incredible how different two members of the same species, like you go and you catch a brook trout out of one of those Caribbean looking ponds, and then you go and you catch a brook trout out of one of the, what I would call a typical main pond. They're no more than 20 miles apart and they look completely different.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's such a special place. There's so many different things to get into.
Some of those remote waters too. Maine has so much water. People forget how big Maine is. If you haven't been to Maine, you know, look at the map of the country again, and then just think comparatively a second. Look at all the other states in New England, and then look at how big Maine is. Really underrated for its size, and then also its angling opportunities. There are just so many. We've already touched on some of them. There are some that are like unlabeled. You know, if you take a Maine map, there are some that are just territories that are labeled by numbers, you know, and mm-hmm. I forget how the coding is, but it's like, where were you fishing? Like T2N6, you know, it's just a body of water on a map. And some of them have like, you know, our friend Eddie from college, mm-hmm. but we would take his Jeep and just kind of go off into the mountains on a weekend in between classes. And the same thing, we'd strap an Old Town canoe to the top, go all the way in, and you just have no clue what you're going for or where you're going to end up. But you see all these beautiful, incredible foliage. You know, you're in school during the fall, obviously, so that's an added plus. And you're exploring this water, and like you go get way deep into the mountain. So you said the water's gin clear. You can like see to the bottom in 12, 14 feet. And the dirty water in Maine is like all of our listeners down south, like if they saw it, they'd be, you know, it's their dream water for certain places in Florida or the Chesapeake or whatever. But so much angling opportunity, which is really, really special. And I think underappreciated. And to go full circle here, one of the last times I saw you in person, but what a great, I see you actually have the Oxbow shirt on right now. Or that's
sure
it. Yeah. So,
yeah, but the all striper season.
Yep. Yep, Rising Tide and Oxbow collaboration striper season to let more people know what's going on with striper advocacy. And it's also just a killer beer. So if you're in New England, look for striper season. at your local watering hole and your local package store. And if they don't carry it, ask them to. Helps out ASGA, helps out the cause, helps out Tim and the good folks. But they host that all species tournament.
When they do carry it, buy it by the flat.
Yeah, drink it. Drink it. Drink as many as you can at once and see what happens. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I'm not cutting that out. I'm leaving it in, but I'm kidding for our lawyers. But no, all jokes aside, again, the all species tournament. Last time I saw you, I mean, what, where else can you host a tournament where you just say, size doesn't matter. You just got to catch the species, go forth for 36 hours and see how many you can catch on a fly rod. And people are coming back with 14, 15, 16, 17 species on in like 36 hours. It's really, really incredible. I think Florida.
And you're only allowed two write-ins.
Yes.
So yep. That's you can catch more species than that.
Yes, exactly. True. Count them all. Very true. Yeah. So there's a card, and I don't remember the exact number. Let's say the card has 25 options on it, and then there's two write-ins where you could say creek chub and or whatever isn't on the card. But like you said, yeah, that would open up even more opportunities. But outstanding event. If anyone in New England hasn't fished that event, it's in September, and you should definitely look to do so. I know we've talked about it on the podcast in the past, but that's what a full circle way to encapsulate exactly what that is this is a type place where you can put a pile of people in one room and say, go forth and prosper. And they come back and they've all together caught dozens and dozens and dozens of species on a fly with a variety of skill levels in 36 hours.
And also in like the least pretentious way imaginable, which
yeah.
I think it's just hard to find. Like this state is so clean and there are so many native fisheries. You definitely have your guys that look like they step straight out of the Orvis catalog. You know, they've got $4,000 worth of gear on, but they're going to catch the same fish next to the guy in his duct taped, you know, Nike sandals from 15 years ago.
Who's don't just talk got about his, Eddie like
board
that.
Shorts. He's got his board shorts on. It's like you guys are fishing the same fish, but all species is incredible. I mean, it's just you have access to so many cool fisheries, so many clean fisheries. And it's just good fun. I mean, the prizes are just fun. There's no element of pretentiousness to that tournament at all. That's the most fun I've ever had being near or participating in a fishing tournament.
And unfortunately I will not be at it because, in bad timing, I have decided to start my family. And I have a new one on the way that same month, but John will be at it this year. So if you
That's on you for bad planning on the procreation scheme right there.
I definitely had a hand role in that process. So I will take the lashing for doing so. But yes, John will be at it this year for sure, hanging out at the ASGA table, and I'm sure Pelagic Fisheries, you know, will have some presence here. Mm-hmm. So however it plays out, John will be there. If you enjoy listening and learning more about what John's been up to, obviously you can hit him up on social and everything after this, but come hang out at the All Species with him in September.
Yeah, please.
Put it on your calendar. Meet John this far in advance. You'll be very confused when September rolls around.
Don't specify which John. I feel like everybody knows about 15. Just put it in your calendar and see if you figure it out.
All right. I want to keep this one like relatively quick, just so quick and clean. So it's, you know, just a punch for people to learn a little bit more about you, because I want to have you on here more to dive into all the different topics we talked about. You have a wealth of knowledge on, you know, the stock assessment and you talk about quantitative, you know, being quantitative scientists. And most people probably listening are like, what does half this stuff even mean? Like as you get in the back half of, you know, you're talking about your master's in this career. Okay, this sounds intense. What is this? So we can take a little bit deeper dive right now and then go deeper into the specifics in its own podcast. But why don't you give listeners just a quick spiel about day-to-day. You talked about your current role, how you ended up here. Like, what's a day-to-day look like, maybe as form and function? And so that can include, you know, being at a tournament on a Saturday morning, cutting up tuna heads or whatever. And then also at a higher level, like what your, you know, major goals are. Obviously, you weren't hired just to be a tuna head cutter. Like what is the goal of someone in your role, and what is the higher level outlook of the stuff you're working on right now?
Sure. So I'll take that latest question first. Everything that we do is mostly geared towards, well, it's exclusively geared toward highly migratory species. So again, you're bluefins, your yellowfins, big eyes, your, you know, any of your tunas, a bunch of shark species, your billfish. We work with most, if not all, of those that are accessible here in New England. But everything that we do has the end goal of better informing management. And for this suite of species, for the highly migratory species, a lot of them are internationally managed. So like bluefin are managed by ICAT. ICAT is what decides what we as Western nations get for quota. And then we have to, you know, NOAA will go forth and say, all right, this is how we're going to split it up. But
For our listeners, just to jump in, but for our listeners who are already, you know, overwhelmed by the striped bass stuff and the fact that, like, wait, Maryland gets a, and then Potomac Rivers gets a vote. That doesn't even make sense. That's not even a whole state. And like, if you think the striper drama is already a thing in, you know, all these coastal pelagics that are managed, how about countries that have very distinct financial and sociopolitical and wartime influences and all these different global political dynamics?
Cultural influences. How, like the Mediterranean has been fishing bluefin for thousands of years.
Yes.
Thousands of years.
And we all have to come to a table and be like, hey, we are all countries and this is how many fish we will all take. Ready, break. Mm-hmm. So very, very crazy in and of itself. But yeah, I figured the juxtaposition there, if it didn't sink in, it's very significant.
It's a different world for sure. But yeah, everything that we do is geared toward filling in whatever knowledge gaps there are. So, you know, an example for bluefin, one of our big projects right now, we do a lot of tagging work. And the tagging work is almost always like supplemental to some biological project. Like we have this huge genomics project with, we're looking at close kin mark recapture, which is basically a way of measuring the relatedness between individuals. So like if you went to say Orono and you took hair from some subset of people and tested their DNA to see how many of them are related, it's Orono. You're probably going to find some relatives. Like there's not that many people that live in Orono, you know, it's like 2,000, 3,000 people. I think.
Some bad jokes to make there, but I'm not going to continue.
No, that's further down. So if you went to a smaller place like Orono, you're more likely to find some relatives because it's a small space, it's a small population. Whereas if you went to New York City and you did the exact same thing with the same, you know, say you picked 100 people and you plucked their hair and you wanted to see who was related, you're way less likely to find relatives because there's so many more people. And how that translates to bluefin is this close kin mark recapture gives us the opportunity to measure that relatedness and then back calculate it to get an absolute abundance. So instead of your typical stock assessment model that gives you a relative abundance with some margin of error, you can basically say within a margin of error, but a tighter one, there's this many bluefin in the Atlantic Ocean, which is a really cool thing to be able to say and a really valuable piece of information for management for when you're setting quotas and stuff like that. You know, for things like white marlin, there's no US, there's a sport fishery for them, but there's not a commercial fishery for them. And so you lose the opportunity to get a lot of that, that commercial data, your fishery dependent data. And so what we're doing there is just trying to get a better, like we're putting tags on them. We're trying to get a better understanding of how widely distributed are they. You know, for yellowfin, we know that yellowfin caught in the U.S. tagged in the U.S. have been caught in fisheries off the coast of Africa. And so it's all just geared toward trying to figure out, like, how much of this population are we exposed to? What's the extent of their exposure? Because they're highly migratory, so they're exposed to international fleets. But just trying to find those gaps and fill them as best we can. So we do tons and tons of work to do that. A lot of the stuff that I do personally is a lot of the tagging work. So I program a lot of our tags for, I don't know if you can hear the 747 engine in the background here, but I've got a computer right now that's trying to process a model for a tag we put on a basking shark.
That's humane budget computer. Windows 97 trying its hardest to keep up.
Not this one. Not this one. This one's going to be working for a long time and it's a beefy system, but I mean, that's just the nature of it. So we do a lot of different projects that are trying to fill those gaps. That one's sort of in relation to offshore wind and habitat utilization. The bluefin one is kind of gets at a lot of different things, different substock structures, stuff like that. But that's a lot of what I do, is a lot of the data visualization for the mapping stuff. If you follow our socials, I create all of those maps. I try to make them as digestible as possible for the public, because the public seems to like them pretty well. Bluefin are cool. They're a big, sexy species. They go really far. We've got tracks going over 13,000 miles, you know, and that's kind of that's like crazy. A minimum. Yeah, that's not even like an archive. That's only a portion of the data, so you can treat it as a minimum. But
let's plug, of course. I mean, just scraping the surface, right? You guys are doing so much incredible work. The social, like on Instagram, it's Pelagic Fisheries Lab is the handle. I assume the Facebook is in and of the same nomenclature, but very much worth the follow for sure. I was before you even said the social plug there, I was thinking, you know, we'll have to try to find a way. Maybe we do hop on and do one of these podcasts sometimes and do use the video and put it on YouTube. Just a shorter one, just so you could show off some of that stuff. We do on the ASGA YouTube right now, which is far from Yeti Presents, you know, not millions of followers, but we do have some videos on there, and one of them, or one playlist on the ASGA YouTube, is the videos from the science symposiums that we have hosted in the past, one of which was on Cape Cod before the school tournament. And we have one called Mysteries of the Migrators, Researching Highly Migratory Species. And that was Walt a year ago. So obviously we're going to try to get Walt on here again soon. And I'm sure there's, with all the work you guys are doing, there's been a whole lot of changes and updates and all sorts of crazy and cool stuff. But if anyone is interested over the weekend, or while they're driving to a boat ramp or a work commute or whatever, you do have that, and I'm 99.9% sure. I should know this as the producer. I'll have to ask my boss. That doesn't exist. But that episode is also a podcast on the Guidepost. So if you just search in the Guidepost and go search migrator, highly migratory species, you can listen to that just as audio as well. Through the YouTube is more compelling because it has, you know, all the visuals from his presentation. But really, really cool stuff. I don't want to dip our toes into it too deep and not do it justice to really dig more into the weeds about all the tagging and mapping stuff, because I think that's worthy of its own podcast. But what does it look like? I mean, sometimes I'll FaceTime you and ask you a question or something like that, and you're like, sorry, I couldn't pick up. I was covered in like tuna blood or something. So there's a very, you know, you went full nerd on us for a second, showed us how smart you are. But
apologize.
What is the hands-on side of this job look like on a summer at a tournament? And obviously you guys have a whole team and everyone's working hard and rowing in the same direction. But why don't you tell people a little bit more about, okay, how the heck do you, if you want to use the otoliths, you know, the little structure in a tuna's head to learn a little bit more about it, how it's aged, all the other crazy stuff that you guys are learning from, how the heck does a group, a lab of students and professionals obtain tuna heads? Like, walk us through that little hands-on experience.
The industry is our most invaluable asset. Fishermen that are willing to collaborate with us, dealers that are willing to collaborate with us, tournament directors that are willing to collaborate with us. They are the people that make all of this work possible. I mean, its value is tremendous, but to make it possible, it takes more than a village. we just started our field season. The bluefin fishery up here just opened June 1st. So we've got our fresh set of interns and technicians for the summertime. But there are three of us full-timers. There's a handful of interns and two seasonal technicians that will work for us throughout the summer. And then we have a handful of graduate students too that will step in when the interns have to go back to school. But essentially what we do is we try to get ourselves at every tournament that's really feasible. I mean, that can be tournaments down in Maryland, but a lot of them are up here in Maine. And we're asking people if they're willing to donate their head, donate the stomach, you know, donate the gonads. It's their fish. They own every part of it. And so we have to ask the question. And we've built a lot of relationships with individual fishermen doing it that way. But Walt if you do end up listening to the podcast or you do end up watching his presentation, you'll learn very quickly that Walt is an incredibly, incredibly charismatic person. Mm-hmm. The passion that he has for HMS, for highly migratory species, is infectious. And so he's been really successful in getting us involved with, I say us, he's been doing this long before I worked in the lab. But since 2011, he's been building relationships with dealers, and that network has grown to a point where we're processing upwards of 2,000 bluefin a year. Sometimes a little bit less, sometimes more. Depends on what the fishery looks like in that year. But that's between June and December, you know, subject to quota periods, which is a whole different topic.
And that's not filleting a brook trout, strange. Too. So processing a tuna, that is not a 5 minute ripping through mahi at the flight table.
No, certainly not. Yeah, we're not lifting brook trout with a crane at whatever brook trout tournaments there may be. I don't know of any. If you're not familiar with bluefin tuna, they are humongous. They're the largest tuna species. They can be well over 1,000 pounds. I think the world record is like 1,496 pounds from Nova Scotia. So when you lop the head off a fish that big, the head itself is like 60 to 100 pounds. And as Cody kind of hinted at, there's a structure in there called the otolith, which is a calcified ear stone. We can section the core of that and then get an age estimate from that fish, just like you would a tree. When you cut those structures, they have daily depositions throughout their life. And so you see their growing cycles. And by counting the rings, you know, you get like wide rings for growing seasons and then really tight rings for like, in salmon, it would be like sea winters, but like the non-foraging periods. And those two things combined equal a year. So you can age the fish in the same way that you'd age like a tree stump. But we pick up those heads twice a week from dealers in Boston and Gloucester. And we used to have some in New Hampshire that have kind of moved around. We've got folks here in Portland. We got a good colleague up in Harpswell. And we bring them all back and we have these massive processing days. So we do our work now in the Portland Fish Exchange, and it's an interesting sight to see if you haven't seen it. It's just like a graveyard of dozens. We've had days of 120 heads, but generally it's like dozens of, again, 60 to 100 pound bluefin heads just stacked up on the concrete floor with the top of the head cut off. We use these giant sawzalls with 12 inch blades to cut that cap off and get this little tiny ear stone.
Again, not a Dexter fillet knife. This is not a small process.
No, you're not getting to those with a knife. Probably not with all your fingers anyway. But yeah, it's funny because like if you look at an 8 inch or 10 inch cod, they'll have the same size otolith as an 800 pound bluefin.
That's
because they're a bottom species. I mean, they utilize that part of their physiology much more than a bluefin needs to. And so you're cutting into this huge, huge head to get this tiny, tiny, tiny thing. And then you're going to cut a tiny sliver out of that tiny thing. But it's all, like I said, for the benefit of the management. The tournaments are crazy valuable. When we go to dealers, you know, they're giving, it's basically garbage. It's their garbage. When they get a tuna, they're going to cut the head and the tail off, and it's basically just going to be thrown away. Sometimes dog food companies will come pick it up, which if you love your dog, look for that. Maybe don't give them that, because when we pick it up, it's definitely not food grade anymore. So we try to get out in front of those guys so that we can get, you know, the valuable pieces of research out of it. But that said, you only get the head. You don't have the whole body. You don't know how much it weighed. You don't know how long it was. You don't have any visual representation of the fish if you were to ever look at morphometrics or something like that. And that's where you don't even know what gear type they used. You know, these dealers are buying from people out of the harpoon category. They're buying from people out of the rod and reel category. And there's no way to trace that back when it's just a tub full of fish heads. So that's our way of using basically their garbage. But when we go to the tournaments, that's where we get like the full suite of information. I mean, we see the fish come off the boat that caught the fish. We interact with the guy that landed it. We see it for its whole weight. We see it for its dressed weight. We get the stomachs. We get the kidneys, the livers, the gonads, the head, you know, the tissue sample, like all of this stuff. And it gives us a really unique opportunity to create these like individualistic reports where it's not just, okay, here's some bluefin head that got landed in the commercial fishery. It was 12 or 30 years old, you know, whatever. It's here's a fish that was landed on this date by this vessel at this tournament. It was this old. It came from this population using whatever you want to do. You can use either the genetics to figure out what population it came from, or you can use the stable isotopes from the otolith to figure out where in the world it was born. But you've got the age, you've got the population, you've got the place it was spawned, you've got what it was feeding on the last week, because you have the stomach there, you have the liver that you can do stable isotope on. You can submit part of that for this, you know, close kin market capture thing that I was telling you about before. It's just, you get everything that you can get from those opportunities. So the opportunity to work with those folks, I cannot stress enough how important they all are to making this what it is. If it weren't for industry involvement, we wouldn't be doing this.
And that's a really, really great example and a shining example of how this collaboration should work, where it's anglers totally. And scientists on the same team learning together, learning in a way that can inform management that's better for the fishery, better for the anglers. And I don't even want to delve into an example of what I'm about to say, but there's a lot of things going on right now where science has not always worked cohesively with the angling industry. With you have this kind of separation in certain fisheries between science and angler, and it makes a whole wealth of drama. And the most disappointing part for someone like myself, and also for, you know, the ASGA brand personified, is that reliance on sound science, wanting to contribute to sound science. If we don't know something, let's go learn it. If we think we know something, let's prove it again. If we think science is bad, let's do it again. Let's improve it. But being a science-driven organization, and it's really difficult to have those conversations and guide advocates, guide people to the light of saying, you know, this is the way we should go. This is how we can all row together. When you erode that trust in science, and when you get that separation, it can make those conversations really, really difficult. So you guys are a shining example of this is how we work together, because the angler has this information that they don't even necessarily know they have the access to just by having a head on a tuna that's going in a dumpster if you guys don't do something with it. Well, how can we collaborate together in a way that we're, well, utilizing the resource, extracting from it, whether it's in a tournament, whether there's industry based around it, you know, all these wreck tunas that are caught, they're driving tons of sales, not only putting food on the table for anglers taking them home, but they're driving sales of plugs and rods and gears and fuel and all the, there's a whole economy mm-hmm. based around bluefin. But on top of all that, you have this wealth of information that's out there just from these catches. And it's more so, like you just said, it's more so than tuna X this many pounds caught here. It's so much deeper than that. And the lab's ability, your skill set, your knowledge, and also your ability to collaborate with the industry is allowing us to take that next level and get a little bit deeper. And I think that's a great example and something that we can hope to continue to see around the country is how can we start bridging these gaps? To go full Definitely. Circle back to what we talked about, all the different types of scientists, right? It's my own personal opinion. I'm not afraid to say it. Some scientists suck at being human. Like you can be smart as you can be, but like if I talk to you and walk away saying who or what the hell was that, like it doesn't matter if your brain is smart enough to understand the grand depths of the ocean and the best ways to logically calculate all these things around it. You have to be able to convert that into human, not only to communicate it a la what we do at ASGA, you know, here's these researchers, here's what you need to know from this research, not just to get it into layman's terms, but to build trust around it so that it can be implemented into things like management, where it's not science for science sake. It's not that one guy proved that X equals 12 and now he can get it peer reviewed and anoint himself the king of this number because he has learned it. It's X equals 12. Well, now what does that mean for us? How can we use this number? How can we use what we've learned to make the world a better place? And there are some scientists that are really bad with it. I'm thinking of some of them right now, and I'm classy enough to not name them. But a huge kudos. You said it a little bit ago, and I wanted to tap back on it and make sure I didn't forget. Walt's an incredibly human person. You talked about Dr. Ellis from UMaine, incredibly human person. You yourself, very smart dude, but also when we get together, one, we act really stupid, but two, we're human, right? So it's like you understand these things, but what do we want to do on a week? We're not sitting around thinking, oh, we are scientists and we will, you know, execute these things and rule the world. Just some dudes that want to go fish or take photos or have a good time, have a good drink, go hike in the wood. Like, it's really important that science stays human. So while these incredible minds lead us towards a better understanding of our oceans, that it's also connected to our community in a way that actually can be implemented. And I'm not saying that you guys have the system totally figured out, because I'm sure you guys have some sticking points where there are certain ways that certain people that are tough to work with, certain ways that it's difficult to do so. You know, connecting science with the constituents of an angling community or of a state or a nation or whatever is not easy in and of itself. But I think you guys do a really good job, and that obviously comes from Walt's personality top down and his leadership.
Yeah, I mean, Walt is another person that grew up in Connecticut, but he grew up in a fishing family. Like, the people that he interacts with, that I see him interact with the best, are the industry, are the fishermen. And he and I have sat in meetings. You know, we're both scientists. He's much more of a biologist than I am. I'm much more of a statistician than he is. We've both sat in meetings and just looked at each other like, what? What just happened? What are we talking about right now? Like, I have degrees in this and I'm sitting in the meeting confused.
Yeah.
I went to school for this and I feel lost. So the human element.
We're hoping that, you know, your participation in some of these conversations, especially that the ASGA community cares about, is going to be relevant. I hope some people listening are thinking like, man, fuck yeah. Ooh, I just swore. Man, I'll say it again. $10. Fuck yeah. We got John in this. I'm not going to bleep it out. Who cares? Someone report me. But, you know, we got John on our team now, right? Like, we got John involved in these conversations because we've had you, you know, hey, John, this is going on. You want to just sit in and listen on this? And you would even walk away from a quick toe dip in some sort of the science technical committee for striped bass or another species and be like, well, I mean, the way they're doing this doesn't make any sense, or that's a little confusing. Like, with these other species, that's the way that they're doing it is actually like the most frowned upon way and whatever. So to have a new lens to look at some of these other things, I think is really, really, really exciting. So I hope a lot of people listening are excited to have your approach to these other things that we care about, because we need, there's too many meetings where, again, this is my personal opinion. I know if Tony was sitting next to me, he'd agree and probably go deeper on the topic, but there's too many meetings where here's the science, it's proposed to the public who are the advocates to comment on it. They're supposed to, you know, download it and understand it to the best of their ability and then give their public comment that's thoughtful, respectful, science-driven, based on the, you know, the hundreds of pages of numbers on a sheet that go into an amendment. But then someone like yourself or someone like Walt, who, you know, has got triple the amount of professional experience you do, could sit in on one of these meetings and walk away and go, what the hell were they talking about? Like, I don't even think those guys know what they're talking about. And so the fact that you brought that up, where you guys were, sit, you know, can still be in a room and be like, this, it doesn't matter how accurate or scientifically appropriate it is to go down a certain way, a certain thematic, to try a new strategy. It's like, this has to end up being human at some point, or it's all frivolous.
Well, in it's multifaceted too. Like, you've got the communication of the science, which has to be human. It absolutely has to be human, especially if you're going to ask people to give their public comment. You should also expect that they understand what happened. And I don't think we can make that assumption probably most of the time. I sat in an hour and 20 minute long meeting, and it took me about 4.5 hours total to figure out what the meeting was about. So at that point, when I felt like I had my head wrapped around the topic, the meeting had been over for 3 hours.
Yeah. And you're, so what do you do with that? You're literally right. A professional in this. So how does just Jim and his two sons who love fishing on a weekend, they're like, man, we're noticing that insert the species, things are changing, negative, positive, somewhere in between. We want to try to be an advocate. We love conservation. We're going to participate in fisheries management. They tune into that meeting. How long? They're making it 10 minutes, maybe at most, before they're Zoom off. Like, yeah, we're
the
done.
Eyes are glassing over or taking a nap. But yeah. I mean, that's just on the scientific end. Even if you go through the whole scientific end, as you should, in the most human way possible, that's easily accessible to people who don't have multiple degrees in marine science or fishery science or statistics or whatever topic is part of fisheries. There's the translation from that science to a management directive. And so there's other meetings where you sit in here and you're like, man, that was a really strong survey. That was really good data. And then the management decision comes out the other end. And you're like, how did we get here? How did we make this decision from this available information?
Yeah.
You know, so it's a multifaceted approach where there are a lot of fisheries in the U.S. that have significant need for improvement.
Mm-hmm. That might be an understatement.
yeah, big time. I'd say bluefin, we're incredibly lucky to work with bluefin because I think bluefin, we're kind of, I hope nobody bites my head off for saying this, but I feel like we're kind of in that end stage. And the end stage being it's not 100% because it's never going to be, but we have general support from the industry, right? Like that, the bluefin are doing well. The population part of this close-skin market capture thing, some of our data fed into that, contradicted the traditional stock assessment and suggested there's more fish than we thought there were. And so we all got a 20% increase in quota this year because of the CKMR research. Like, how often does that happen in fisheries where you do research and it says, yeah, there are more. Go ahead, do your thing. Fishermen, like this is your time. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, oh, we did this research, we need to, you know, cut a bunch of other people off at the knees because we forgot to account for this, or mm-hmm. you know, the thing is not healthy, there's some other input that's not being accounted for that's making this worse than it is. It's like bluefin are actually doing well, we got a quota increase, a lot of the industry's bought in. Once you lose that relationship, that confidence between the industry and the science, it is so hard to get back, if it's even possible to get back. I mean, yeah. New England fisheries are not the beacon for historically well-managed fisheries. Like, there are people driving around with defund NOAA stickers for lots of reasons. But I like to think that the bluefin fishery, not because of us, but just the bluefin fishery because of the state that it's in, is in that position to show this is what happens when you do have trust. This is what happens when you have industry buy-in to research that they know, because it's clear to them, will benefit them. A 20% increase in quota, that's a pretty clear benefit to somebody who's a fisher person, that, you know, that they don't have the degree in statistics or biology or fisheries management or fisheries policy even. Like, those are all unique degree programs. They don't have to have any of that. Mm-hmm. They can now go catch more fish. There's no easier way to make that translation of we're doing things well. Because we're doing them well, we're managing them well, and we're understanding them better, you can go catch more.
Yeah.
Easy.
Yep. And each fishery has its own flaws relative to the communities that are involved in it, relative to the dynamics. Are they largely release? Are they largely harvest? There's, you know, a lot of details, you know, where those fisheries are relative to specific states, what state that state, you know, what their departments, their resources have, what major schools do they have in their area. And so there's resources and all sorts, there's a million dynamics that play into it. So they all are of their own accord. But this is a really cool example for how things can work. Mm-hmm. Relatively, you know, again, speaking in generalities, not saying that everything is perfect, and this is not my comments on tuna management or ASGA's, you know, comments on tuna management, but just seeing how that collaboration can work. And again, I'm going to come back to it, and there's going to be some scientist that's offended by this. And you know what? If you're offended by this, it probably means because it applies to you. So keep being offended. I don't care. But it's the fact that you guys, and like you said, you weren't claiming that, you know, this tuna, it was solely because of the Pelagic Lab by any means, but because of organizations or groups like you guys and your ability to work with humans, that's really important, because you and I have seen it in person many a times throughout our professional career and personal adventures, but you can tell when someone who's on the science side of these relationships, if you took that person and put them on the dock, especially in maybe saltier crews like tuna fishermen, offshore guys, ground fishing guys, you put person X, the science young, upcoming, aspiring science nerd X, and you say like, oh, go talk to that person. You know, right, that conversation's going to last about 10 seconds before one of those two parties hates each other, or, you know, or both hate each other, that, you know, that cohesiveness is not there. So you can't also be bridging these social and cultural gaps while trying to bridge a literal intellectual gap of not saying one's smarter than the other, but a depth, a field of study that's so complex. So you're already trying to bridge the fact this person knows a lot about just how fisheries data is accumulated or how it's analyzed. Well, okay, well, this person knows a lot about catching fish. Then these two need to meet each other in the middle. But that always can't happen if the two representatives meeting that relationship are not going to mesh that way. So keeping science human is so incredibly critical.
Totally. And to kind of circle back to the beginning of this episode, you had mentioned field work and field skills. That's where field work and field skills come hand in hand. Because I can't tell you how many times, and I'm sure you've seen it too, you got the people that go to school, they get their degree, they read every textbook that they needed to read, and they know everything about what they read their textbooks on. That is not the case. You have a very small pocket of information that is like incredibly directed toward your career and your career choice, your career path. That does not translate to you're standing on the back of the boat and you, because you read the textbook on their biology and their life history, you can go catch them. That is a whole different suite of knowledge. And the quicker you learn that, the better you'll get along with fishermen.
Yeah.
And the more respect you'll have for the industry that you're supposed to be working for
or if you can even handle the fish. I mean, I've seen places where there's certain people where they're like, they're going to do the tag, they're going to do whatever procedure. And you're like, have you been outside ever in your life? Like, do your parents let you out of the attic to see the sun ever? Like, you're going to do the, you know, but give me that knife. I'll do it. You know, I'll put the tag in for X or Y. And again, before anyone starts reading into anything that says nothing to do with anything ASTA related, we're actually really lucky. You can tell by the type of scientists that we like to work with that we keep it around people who keep it real. So I'm speaking well before my ASGA time, just in our undergrad and slightly postgrad careers. And I even, you know, I say, quote unquote, left the field, but took a tangential path while you stayed in the sciences. And I still had these experiences where you go like, oh my God, man, you might have got 100 on all four of the tests, the major tests this semester, but I wouldn't let you near me with a scalpel. Like, you might stab yourself before you stab the brook trout. Like, these people. Yeah.
When I worked for Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, I had a brief break where the weather was terrible. We were supposed to do pond surveys and we couldn't. And so I was just like floating around the office. And the office had the handwritten paper creel surveys going all the way back to the 50s and 60s for Baxter, which was unbelievable. And I flipped through tons of them. And you could see creel surveys where you've got these folks that are catching 4, 5, 6 pound brook trout in bodies of water that I've fished for days. And they're just not in there anymore for various reasons. Not anything necessarily bad. It's just fisheries change, especially if you all of a sudden don't have a paper mill's worth of people removing fish from what are pretty small ponds. You end up with lots of mouths to feed and no bigger of a forage base. So they all just end up being runts. But I read through tons of those trying to figure out how, because one of the questions is, what are you using? Artificial lure, live bait, you know, worm, whatever. Sometimes people will give you the information. A lot of times people won't give you the time of day. But I was just trying to figure out, like, how do I hone my skill set to figure out these brook trout and these salmon? Did all kinds of reading, you know, oh, salmon have soft mouths. They do this barrel roll so they can pull the hook really easy. And some people are using this and other people are using this. And I think anybody who goes at any body of water to try and figure it out with no context and no help knows that it takes time. It takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of trial and error, regardless of how much you read or how much insider information you have access to that most people otherwise wouldn't. Like, most people don't know that those creel surveys are there. Most people aren't going to have the time to go sit down and read them. And I'd still struggle. And I remember one day I came across this guy who had you know, like a vest, like a fly fishing vest on. And, you know, where people usually have that real puffy, you know, it's either the foam or like the patch of fur, dry mm-hmm. fly off or whatever. He had a pocket filled with every color Sharpie in existence. It's like, well, what do we got going on here? This is interesting. And I went to go talk to the guy and I asked him about it. I was like, so what's the story with all the Sharpies? And he lifted up like the top of his pocket and he had all his flies in that pocket. They were all white. There were like a few different types of flies, but every fly in that little pad was tied in all white. And he was like, what I do is I never know what, because up there you can have hatches by the week. Like they can be on one thing and 4 days later, they won't touch it. They're on to something else. And he would go up there and he would figure out what was hatching at that time. And he would take out whatever relevant Sharpies there were to match that thing. And he'd turn his white fly into whatever it was that was hatching. And I just remember sitting there being like, that's brilliant. Like that is an absolutely brilliant solution to what is not really a complicated problem, but like a difficult one to predict or to, you know, adopt into any form of consistent knowledge where you just like show up, throw this fly and catch this fish. But that was like my first experience where I came across a fisherman who's just, you know, a recreational fisherman who was like, oh my God, this guy is a genius in his own right. And then every opportunity I had after that, where working with people in the groundfish sector, working with people, you know, just interacting with lobstermen on the docks, interacting with all these, the tuna fishermen. It's like, these people are very, very, very smart. They're very smart. They're very good at their craft. If they weren't, they wouldn't be doing it. They have a lot of knowledge to offer. Sit there and listen to them, because it'll be a benefit to everybody. You have to be able to have that connection between what you're learning in a classroom or what you're learning from a book or what you're modeling on a computer to what you see and feel and touch with your hands and what these people are telling you from their experiences. You know, if a ground fisherman says, oh, well, there's all kinds of cod in the Gulf of Maine, and your model says, oh, there's no cod in the Gulf of Maine, he's not lying to you. He's just really good at catching cod. So like your model has to be able to account for that type of thing. But, you know, the example being like the information is valuable. You can't just write that off. It has to be a handshake, you know, your information for mine. Let's work together. Let's get this thing figured out. This is how fisheries is successful. And when that handshake doesn't happen, it's not successful.
Yeah. The utopia, right? Like you said, is that acknowledgement from the science side, like, these are not just some big, dumb, stupid fishermen. Oh, they're a wealth of knowledge and sometimes multi-generational wealth of knowledge. Not, you know, they're doing it the way their grandpappy taught their dad taught them. So you have not just their 30 years on the water, but this is 90 years compressed of fishing for X, Y, and Z. But it has to be a two-way street too. So it can't just be that, you know, the angler is smart. And like you said, the angler is really good at catching cod. So that means that there's more cod than there's ever been. And there has to be that two-way level of respect of the science side saying these anglers have so much information that we have yet to scrape the surface of unless we build these relationships and obtain this information and grow and learn together. The angler has to accept, just because I'm incredible at catching fish doesn't mean that I know how to manage fisheries or that totally. I know how to model fisheries. And so In utopia, the utopian land, and maybe we'll end on this just to give people like a positive utopian approach to where we should be striving for, is the scientist says, oh, fisherman, teach me how to catch fish and show me your ways. And the fisherman says, you know, oh, scientist, can you show me how to make sense of all of this? These are my experiences. How can I best understand what's going on? Because to look at what's going on with stripers, you could have two boats a quarter mile apart. One of them boated 10 fish over 40 inches this morning, and it's the best season he's ever had. Today was his first day fishing this year. Best day he's ever had. Another boat quarter mile up the river, in the bay, whatever, got skunked this morning. Saw a couple, got skunked. That's a 10-year guide. You know, had clients who are relatively skilled, and years ago they would have caught them with that crew that caught them in the past, and they got one small owner, they got skunked. both of those experiences are true. And both of the people experiencing them, they're justified in saying, I experienced X. So this is my reaction to it. It's the best of all time or it's the worst of all time. How does this system work in utopia? That scientists and modeling perspectives and managers who can recognize the socioeconomic impacts, that phrase gets thrown around a lot and in disgusting and often malicious ways.
Yeah, that's a good $10 word right there.
Yeah, well, it gets weaponized by people who's like, you just don't understand it, but the socioeconomic impacts, and you're like, oh, really? That's, you know, you're deploying that term? But that is a real thing, right? You know, a fishery is the money based on the fishery, right? Our tagline is better business through conservation. When there's more fish in the water, more hotels book, more tackle shops booming, more rods and reels imported, exported, all that stuff, right? If you can take, you have a manager who can take that into account. You have scientists who can, and anglers who can meet halfway and share their perspectives. And then the scientists say, based off of all the different individual experiences from all these boats, this is our best idea. Here we're proving our math. This is how we got here. This is our best idea of how things are going. They're going great. Let them catch more. Things are not going bad. Shut it down. Things are somewhere in the middle. Let's take a cautious approach. And then the managers take feedback from everyone. And they say, based off all of this stuff, we've looked at it. Here's our most thoughtful approach to how this should be managed for this year, how a size should be set for this year, how a quota should be set. That's utopia, right? And there's a lot of things at play in there. There's ego. There's cultural differences. There's intellectual differences. There's economic. There's money moving behind the scenes. Not that I don't mean economic impacts in the coastal communities. I mean money moving behind the scenes in ways that it shouldn't or traditionally always has. These are all the dynamics that attack utopia. Mm-hmm. And so I love the theme that we just got onto. I hope our listeners that made it this far enjoyed having John on. John was like, I told y'all this was going to be short, and I guess I fucking lied to you. That's my third F-bomb of the day, but I'm fired up. But no, really enjoyed having John here, and let us know what you thought of this podcast. You know, do you want to hear more of John? Do you want John to shut up and go back to just go fishing in Baxter and get far away from a podcast mic? But no, all jokes aside again, had a really good time, dude. Thanks for hopping on. Let's do our best to keep science human. I think that might be the thematic for this, is that is where utopia lies, is when we can keep that human and bridge those relationships. But we have so much more to learn from you, from your wife, Sammy, and from Walt. And I think those are all conversations worthy of themselves, and getting deeper into what she works on specifically and a wealth of his background and his theories. Absolutely. On all the stuff we just talked about. And then we'll have you on more, not only to take deeper dives into careers in the sciences and the mapping and tagging and all that stuff you're doing, and then also hopefully get your perspectives on some of these other stuff, you know, the other fisheries that we're involved in that you haven't dabbled in as much, but you're going to start doing so more of, you know, peek behind the curtain and say, whoa. Maybe have you guys looked at X? You know, because it's funny, even science doesn't always cross-pollinate. The tuna researchers and the striper researchers might be working, trying to solve the same problem for their fisheries in vastly different ways. And sometimes those comparing of notes could save a lot of headaches or make us more efficient or whatever. And those don't always get crossed.
We all too often work in a vacuum, where we just have the blinders on to our task and our problem and our fishery. And if we were a little bit better at having that cross-pollination, I think things would get done a little bit quicker.
Cool. Well, any closing remarks you want to throw out? Or otherwise, I mean, I think it's just stay tuned. We got a lot more to chat about.
Yeah. Thank you very much for having me. And I appreciate the good conversation. I love the theme. I agree. I think utopia is when everybody has something to give. You know, you give your knowledge on fishing to a scientist. The scientist gives you their information from the scientist's perspective. The manager gives you the implications of whatever decision. Everybody's got something to give. When it's too easy to introduce somebody who's got something to take, and that's just where it all starts to degrade.
I was about to say, if you're one of the people who only takes, you're an asshole.
But yeah, thank you again for having me. It was an absolute pleasure. I look forward to the next one.
Cool, dude. Enjoy your weekend.
You as well.